Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and my good friend Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, brother? How are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you for joining me today, and thank you all for listening. Welcome to the show. I guess we should just, we did a little bit of banter prior to, in like our pre-warm-up mode. So I guess we should just get right to the episode, right?
Yep. And if you're interested in hearing the nonsense that we were talking about before, you can support us on Patreon, where we'll be releasing exclusive content like our weird banter.
Yeah, what we were talking about before was completely incoherent and probably cannot be considered a rational thought, but these types of warm-ups are necessary to get into the flow of things.
Yeah.
But I guess what we're trying to do is the last four episodes that we did all were related to China in some way or another. And it's kind of uncharted territory, really, for us. We've only done a handful of episodes on China prior to the four we just did. Mm-hmm. And it all started off by doing an episode on the Uyghurs, just seeing who these Uyghurs were, what's going on with these re-education camps, exploring, you know, the bad things the Chinese government is doing. But ultimately, we were debunking the notion that China is some unified state.
So and it's one ethnicity or one culture, things like that. And that's what we learned doing, you know, doing the research for the Uyghurs. And we kind of found it, you know, almost interesting, but kind of necessary to talk about, you know, what was the invention of the Chinese people and how it related to, you know, the situation with the Uyghurs in the end. And that turned into like a little mini series, if you will, where we explored, you know, the ancient history of China, you know, followed by, you know, some of the middle periods in the Qin dynasty that ultimately unified China. And, you know, we capped it off with an episode about Mao and the Cultural Revolution. And it got us really thinking, you know, it was like, we talk a lot on this show about what is a nation and like how are they born. And so I think what we've decided to do is try out a new theme where we're going to talk a little bit about what makes a nation. Like, how are they built? How are they formed? And, you know, we're going to pick a couple of countries to kind of do some case studies for. And over the next couple episodes, we'll do case studies for specific countries and just see what we can learn, you know?
This is more of an exploration rather than some like definitive podcast on, you know, what a nation state is. Like, we're doing this to not only just indulge in this academic pursuit. I mean, I feel like a lame-o saying academic pursuit, but we are doing it for our own indulgences. But I figure it'd be fun for people to listen to us as we really kind of just brainstorm like what is a nation state while using actual countries as case studies. And we're going to be starting off with Japan. We also were talking about doing one on Russia and then doing one on Germany as well. But we're going to start off with Japan because Danny and I already have a pretty good base knowledge of Japanese history, so we figured it would be a pretty, it would be a good starting point, at least for this type of episode. What makes Japan so unique is that there's really no other country like Japan in the world. There's no other country that has even a remotely similar type of history than Japan. It's defined by a lot of really unique circumstances. And one of the main circumstances that pops up in my mind right away is Japan's ability to close the doors and open the doors when they want.
Yep.
Which has shaped a lot of Japanese culture. Their ability to isolate themselves from the rest of the world. And
or
then
their in the completely opposite way, their ability to just straight up sponge off of their neighbors. I think the geography is a huge, huge part about it, not just because they're an island, but because of like how the island is made up. You know, there are so many very unique things about this, and it's going to be fascinating. And the first thing that popped up into my mind was, you know, I wanted to explore this idea, this notion that Japan is like this, or was this secluded island nation, and that they were their own little thing, and, you know, they're special, which they are special. But what I learned in doing the research is that actually they're very heavily influenced by a lot of other people, a lot of other peoples, and their, you know, ethnic makeup and their demographics and the creation of their peoples is just fascinating. And I can't wait to talk about it.
Well, let's start off with the geography. So Japan is an island nation. It's predominantly four main islands surrounded by a bunch of smaller islands. Mm-hmm. The main geographic characteristic of Japan that really shaped its political culture, there's two of them. One, it's an island. Mm-hmm. And then two, it's mountainous.
So, and three, it's volcanic.
Volcanic. And then four, it's on about four Teutonic plates and has earthquakes all the time.
Tectonic plates. Yeah.
Tectonic plates. So it has a lot of disadvantages and also advantages. The advantage, obviously, is that it could protect itself from foreign invaders. And you'll see that in the future. The disadvantage, they really don't have any natural resources.
Right. Or limited natural resources.
Or limited. Another advantage is that they have extremely fertile soil.
Huge. So great on agriculture. Yeah.
A disadvantage, it's so mountainous, all the populations are pushed into about
small
four small pockets, these small plains areas. And these areas are just heavily populated and heavily crowded. So this country also experiences absolutely terrible, probably the worst in the world, natural disasters. So we're talking about earthquakes that kill 100,000 people. We're talking about tsunamis.
Mm-hmm.
Just the worst natural disasters probably any area in the world really receives on a consistent basis is in Japan. Now, the death toll isn't as high as they were in the 1920s when 100,000 people died in an earthquake. Death is mitigated just due to the technological advancements they've made over the past 50 years.
Right.
But I guess a good point to start off is the creation myth, right? There's always, every good nation has a nice little creation story. So I want to hear what Japan's creation myth is.
This one's fun.
Who knows if it's myth?
Well, yeah, who knows, you know? So this one's interesting. I'm going to dumb it down. It's an interesting story, and I definitely recommend reading a lot of these creation myths. But this one in particular had me lolling or laughing out loud. So you've got these two deities in heaven. There's apparently many of them. This part I don't understand very well. But the two that we're talking about are Izanagi and Izanami. Izanagi is the guy. Izanami is the girl. And so Izanagi, apparently, he dips his spear into the waters, and that's how he creates the land. It basically drips off of his spear and coagulates into land. And presumably that land is Japan. And then they go down to the land to like populate it. And there's also this bit, I think Izanagi and Izanami are brother and sister. There's a lot of incest in the story, so you're just going to have to try and follow along.
Every mythology is riddled with incest.
Yeah, it's a ton of it. And then, so they go down to the land, they go to populate it, and they have a bunch of kids, right? But part of this, you know, they have a bunch of this divine offspring, and they're kind of birthed in interesting ways. Like there's definitely like regular vaginal birth, but like some of it would like come out of their nose or like come out of their eyes or like their hands or weird shit. But the one very important birth was the god of fire. When the god of fire was born, it was a vaginal birth and it burned Izanami alive and she died from it. And as a result, Izanagi goes down to the underworld to bring Izanami back, but she was all like dead and crusty and shit. So that didn't work out too well. And so Izanagi gets back and he like washes himself off in a river because he smells like death. And then from this action of washing himself off, apparently a bunch more deities were created. And two of the main ones that were created were Amaterasu, which is the sun goddess, and Susanoo, which is the storm or the sea god. And so we kind of set up this like dichotomy, right? This like sun worshiping dichotomy. This is like super common among a lot of religions, not just Eastern ones. But Amaterasu is mostly seen, this is where it gets a little different from like Western religions. So Amaterasu is seen as like as the main or good deity, whereas Susanoo is seen as like the bad one, kind of, but it's not that cut and dry. And mostly it's because all of the deities in this creation myth have like good and bad qualities. And the texts for these, you know, creation myths, they don't really assign like a moral, you know, code, or they don't put morality behind the actions of these, behind the deities. As an example, Susanoo, he's pretty much a dick. Like if you read the shit that he does, he like annoys the shit out of people, right? Specifically, he annoys Amaterasu and a bunch of the other like deity gods. And basically, rather than calling him like evil or something like that, or like attributing his bad actions as evil, they just banish him. They're like, hey, he's a pain in the ass. Let's just kick him out. Like that's the way that they approach it. It's like very pragmatic. And you know, the rule of thumb for these particular myths is that the morality isn't there, right? It's totally circumstantial. You know, it's not like rules etched into stone, like, you know, Judaism or something like that, right? It's not the Ten Commandments. It's more like, you know, he was a pain in the ass, but you know, it's because, you know, this and that reason, you know? So I think this definitely plays a part in present day Japanese culture. It's very circumstantial. They have very fluid, fluid moral codes. And it's an interesting bit. And the reason why I liked these stories is because of that one particular issue. Now, if you read them, all of the myths from the period are brutal as fuck. They're like Brothers Grimm style shit, right? There's this one bit where one of the deities is getting picked on, and two of the deities split a tree in half and put a wedge in it, and then they stick him in the tree and take the wedge out so that it smushes him and kills him. They also killed the same deity like 12 times or something like that, and he keeps getting reincarnated, and they just keep killing him in different brutal ways. And it's like really funny in one way, but it's also kind of like gory and strange. Definitely interesting read. Definitely would either pick up some of the texts for it, or just like watch a couple of YouTube videos. Some of them are really hilarious when they animate them. But kind of back to the original bits. These deities, they eventually start having offspring of their own, and apparently this great great grandson of Amaterasu, his name was Jimmu, becomes the first ruler of Japan. Right, so this is like the line here, and all of this, by the way, was recorded in the Kojiki, which is the record of ancient things, in 712, also it's in the Nihongi, which is the Chronicles of Japan, in 720. And this was a way for the emperors of the time to legitimize themselves, right? Specifically, Temu, who was the emperor, and to, you know, basically make them say that, oh, they come from a divine family. And what's interesting, I think, about this is the lack of a distinction between these deities like Amaterasu and like, you know, and Susanoo, and men, people, right? They're not distinctly different in any real meaningful way, other than like the, you know, the magical shit that happens. And so you could kind of say that all the Japanese people can claim divine descendants. But specifically, the emperors claim that like super special lineage coming from Amaterasu, the sun goddess. And so I think the idea of legitimizing rulership as divine is definitely not new for the show. You know, we've seen this sprung up a ton of times, you know, in almost every ancient people's creation myths.
So it's kind of like the same, there's a divine right aspect like in Western Europe, like you rule by, but in this case, you're not. In Western Europe or Europe, you know, you're ruling on behalf of God. It's your divine right to rule on behalf of, right, you know, the kingdom of heaven. But in this case, you are actually a descendant of the God.
Right.
There is not a, There's not a distinction between God and man.
Nope.
So Emperor it's actually Hirohito
much more similar to, say, ancient Egypt, where the pharaohs claim to literally be descendant of the gods, rather than, you know, European, which is where they claim to be emissaries of God, you know, or like claim divine, you know, rulership because of gods. So it's very, very close to like ancient Egypt or ancient Mesopotamian, ancient Akkadian, things like that. Like they are the gods.
It's so interesting how all these different civilizations have very similar origin stories.
Yeah.
You think that they would be different as far as at least the, there's always a linkage back to some divine being, some divine creator.
Yeah. And, I mean, shit, Egypt is practically on the other side of the fucking planet as Japan, you know? And yet the creation myths share a lot of the same, you know, tropes.
Well, let's talk about the people who first inhabited Japan. So yep. No one really knows when to pinpoint the start of humans in Japan. And it really could be anywhere from 500,000 years ago to 30,000 years ago, which is quite the spread.
Yeah.
And it's important to note that prior to World War II, Japanese archaeologists don't really give you a clear picture of Japan's prehistoric past, because they would interpret their findings in line with the pseudo-historical accounts from ancient Japanese mythology. We do know the first definitive human fossils, they date back around 30,000 years ago. But even that's a long time ago. And something about Japan is that they have volcanic soil and it eats up skeletons. So yep. We don't really... It's unclear based off things that I've read.
Mm-hmm. Super unclear. And I think a general agreement, though, about Japan's human origins is that they all walked over a land bridge to get there.
Right? Land bridge?
Land bridge.
What's a land bridge?
Well, in this context, not in the...
the real context of what a land bridge
is. In the real context of a land bridge, it's a little bit of science for you. Up until the last glacial maximum, or ice age, about 15,000 years ago, the water levels were trapped up. The water was trapped up in icebergs, right, and on the poles. And so the water levels across the world were much lower than they were. And so as a result, places that appear to be islands like Japan and stuff like that were actually just like peninsulas, right? They were physically attached to the mainland. And it wasn't until after those glaciers started melting, you know, due to global warming or whatever, that these areas like Japan become islands where the lower areas get flooded with water and then eventually become oceans. It's pretty interesting, but there were three, I think, very distinct points of contact with the mainland. There was the Sakhalin in the north, Tsushima in the west, and Ryukyu in the Ryukyu Islands, island chain in the south, which is kind of like near Taiwan. And you know, people basically came in waves from the southeast and from the northeast Asia between something like 30,000 and 14,000 years ago. I think it's pretty hard to paint a good picture of the human life there because of reasons like some that Henry pointed out about the volcanic soil, but also because of the changing topography of Japan. Remember, they got there because there was low water and they were able to cross the land bridge to get to Japan. But once those water levels rose, a lot of the land that people were probably living in at the time are now covered in water. Did you hear about the underwater pyramid, by the way?
Yeah, I was just gonna bring that up. They found a pyramid like structure in like what, 20, 30 years ago, or yep. Probably
in
a little
the,
bit
in
further.
The 80s. Yeah, in the late 80s.
In the 80s, yeah. Off the coast of Taiwan, and they have zero clue where it's from or what it is.
Right, that's the Let me reverse this. Yonaguni-jima. I think it was built by aliens, and you should Google it. It's very fascinating. people still don't know if it was man-made or if it was somehow natural. But like, if you look at that shit, it looks like a step pyramid.
Why do they have to be aliens? I think it's more likely they were built by mermaid people.
Well, mer people.
Mer people.
Well, where do you think the mer people come from?
Merman. They come from Earth.
Space, bro.
Dude.
Space.
Mer. Fish people don't come from space. They come from the deep Atlantis.
Well, where do you think the Atlanteans came from? Space, bro.
They come from God.
I mean, where do you think God comes from? Space.
They come from God. Haven't you? Didn't you ever read The Little Mermaid as the real Little Mermaid?
No, I didn't read as a kid.
I never read the real Little Mermaid either, but I Wikipedia'd it.
Uh-huh.
So I got the basic idea of the story. You know that there was a Disney.
Yeah, there's a Disney-fied
movie
version
called The Little Mermaid, which is probably their biggest movie they did.
Right.
And it's all these Disney stories are based off of
like an original story,
folk stories for children. And the real Little Mermaid is a very depressing, dark story that has a lot of religious undertones. I encourage people to look up the real Little Mermaid, but I digress.
I'm going to have to. where were we? We were talking about human life, early human life in Japan. Okay, so what do we know? What do we know about the early people in Japan? It's not a ton, admittedly, but what we can figure out, or at least what experts think, is that they're mostly hunter-gatherer types. And this is just based on the existing fossil records that they've been able to find further inland. Apparently, they hunted things like boar and deer, which exist still till today. But also, pretty interestingly, big game like elephant and bison, which used to be there, but they've since gone extinct due to global warming and overhunting. And reminds me of that really early show that we did here. Remember that interview that we did? What was the gentleman's
name? Flores?
Yeah, Dan Flores, right. Talking about how all those ancient giant like animals just basically have gone extinct. Same thing here in early Japan. And also there weren't too many natural large predators at the time, so human population exploded. I mean, they do have bears and murder hornets and shit, but like, lions and tigers and shit, that didn't exist.
It's kind of amazing to think that elephant and bison existed there. I feel like there's no room for them to exist.
You would think, but like at the time, remember, land bridge,
Like that makes sense.
They migrated,
That makes sense if they're connected. However, in the U.S., in the Americas, there used to be the United States used to be like the savannah in Africa,
right?
Prior
to the Serengeti, if you will,
It used to be like the Serengeti. It used to have humongous predators. They had
like super bears and like fucking
really large bears,
saber-toothed cats and shit.
They had the American lion was bigger than the African lion. The short-nosed bear was bigger than any bear in North America. Probably the biggest bear that we know to have ever existed.
Yeah.
We had the mega sloth a really big version of the sloth.
Yeah.
But they also just had hundreds of thousands of bison and buffaloes.
And crazy giant deer and shit,
They existed because of all the space in the Great Plains.
Right.
So it's hard to imagine the space for these animals, because it's not like, these mountain ranges have existed for millions of years.
Well, I mean, they were different, though. Like if you look at an Asian elephant and an African elephant, the African elephant is way bigger. You know what I mean? It's like way, way bigger. And that's partly due to the spatial constraints. So I imagine that these elephants are probably closer to like Asian elephants than anything else, but again, it was a different topography, it was a different climate, it was a different everything, a different ecosystem, so it allowed for things like like elephants and bison. Obviously they don't exist anymore, but some other bits about this is that ancient Japanese people evidently formed small like family groups, like extended family groups, and that was super important because apparently the life expectancy was super low. Like most people didn't live to see 30 years old. So, it was important for like extended family to help raise children because a lot of the parents died pretty quickly. jury is pretty much out on how exactly they lived and what their culture was like, but there's still evidence of stuff that we can make some educated guesses on, like, you know, seasonal migration seems to be a thing, but also there was some evidence of people staying put in one spot. One piece of evidence that they found, which I thought was pretty interesting, was that they found obsidian that was evidently traded like 150 kilometers across the sea. Like, they found obsidian from one place that wasn't supposed to be in another place, and the only way to get it over there was by a boat, which means that they had boats and they were using them, which is nuts.
What is obsidian? What is, I don't know what obsidian is.
Oh, you know, it's dragon glass.
Oh. Obsidian, I was like, feeling like a moron. I'm like, should I know this?
Obsidian is just volcanic glass, right? It's okay. it's super useful for tools. It's super sharp, so you can use it for knives and stuff like that, but it's brittle too. Yeah, dragon glass.
Okay, dragon stone, like what to kill the Night Walker.
What kills the White Walkers,
Night King with, excuse me.
Exactly, gotcha. Dragon glass. But the important bit about that is not the dragon glass, it's the fact that they were using boats, you know, which is crazy. And then some, on top of like the geographical stuff that we were talking about, like how the waters increased because of, you know, the ice caps melting, there's also some interesting stuff. It's pretty hard to get a fix on this, but you know, like you were saying before, the Japanese archaeologists were like super hell-bent on like trying to tie together things that they found with like these myths. And it's still till today really hard to do research because a lot of these ancient burial grounds and you know, finds that they find, they end up either getting coded as like these natural preserves by the government, so you can't dig and you can't learn anything more. Or specifically, we'll talk about this later, there's some burial mounds and stuff like that that are technically owned by the empire, by the emperor, and so therefore they're forbidden land and you can't touch them. And there's still like a ton of like mystery and myths surrounding, you know, Neolithic Japanese history, which makes it super fascinating because they don't know the answers. There's more to learn than there is to know.
Yeah. Well, the first remnants of early Japanese civilization are pottery vessels.
Yep.
So pottery. Up until recently, it was believed that Japan had, they may have the oldest pottery, but up until recently, Japan had the oldest pottery vessels ever found recorded in the world. They date back to about 13,000 BC. Recently, I believe they found pottery in China that they date back to 20,000 years ago.
Either but way, it's still fucking
either
old.
Way,
it's old, pretty, old, old. Yeah,
it's very, very old pottery. To give you some context, I don't believe pottery was showing up in the Middle East.
No, not anywhere not even close to
that late or that early in history.
No. And what's interesting is that it sprang up so early, you know, and that this pottery is literally the start of this Jomon period, which was literally named after the cord pattern. Like, they wrapped a cord around the pottery to make a pattern. And that word in Japanese is Jomon. So they literally just got the name Jomon period from the pottery that they found. But now the word Jomon is used to describe the people of the time period itself, as well as, of course, the pottery. But I think calling them Jomon specifically, it suggests that they're like one peoples, but yeah. That's not truly the case. That there were, it was a pretty diverse culture set, you know, and peoples. Jomon population basically ebbed and flowed a lot over several thousand years, and it's not clearly understood why, but maybe it's climate change, geographic conditions, things like that.
There was a big volcanic eruption around 6,000 BC or so.
Yeah, that didn't help.
They believe, I always say they believe because I can't really say I believe because I don't have any kind of background in anthropology. But it is believed that that's why they migrated north. Because initially during the migration, they were in
the south.
They were in the southern part of Japan, and they migrated up north to where their ancestors remain today.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, I mean, just generally speaking, the regions, the climate, and other factors like that, I think play a big role, you know, in the life and the development of these ancient peoples. And so Jomon is just like a convenient catch-all term for ancient Japanese
people. And to just to stay on that point for 1 second, because I think it's important to explain the context of a nation state, which we're ultimately going to try to get into, not on this really episode, because we're going to be talking about early civilization. Mm-hmm. However, the point is in this series is to get to the nation state. And Japan ends up being a very racist place in the future. But I want to just make a point about ethnicity. So Jomon is a term used by anthropologists in the present to describe an ancient peoples. Wasn't like another group of people. We're referring to them as the Jomon. It's not like the Chinese were referring to them as, oh, the Jomon people.
Right.
Or, you know, another... you know, the Han Chinese or the Han Dynasty was like, oh, the Jomon. This is a term from anthropologists. So this is not an ethnic group. And I just want to kind of pony on that.
Yeah, that's
not
super, to confuse that's people. Super important. Yeah.
Because to be considered a peoples, you need to, there's really two aspects to be considered an ethnicity or a people or a group. The way that we think of it is if your group identifies as that group, and if other groups identify you as that group.
Right. It's a two-way street. Right.
It's a two-way street. I encourage you guys to listen to our episode, The Invention of the Chinese People, where we talk a lot about this type of stuff.
About that concept, sure. Yeah, so needless to say...
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
No. That was a good point to make. And I think it's important to point out that there wasn't like one super culture. You know, and it wasn't even one genetic person's there. It was multiple... genetic, you know, pool, you know, the makeup of the ancient Japanese people, as far as research has been done, there was this one article, Henry, you dug this one up. It was fucking fascinating, and it was how they I think it was 137 ancient skeletons, and they did like DNA testing on them to try and figure out like where, you know, what are these people, what are these ancient Japanese people, and. It shows links to a ton of different like Asian groups, including like Mongolic and Chinese and Korean and different types of South Asian. It has something to do with a term called DNA haplogroups. I don't want to butcher it because I'm not a geneticist, but it's honestly fascinating. Look it up if you're interested. The point that I want to make there is that it wasn't a homogeneous group of people. It was many types of people that just ended up in the same place and started breeding.
And they were typically, I mean, they had different cultures as well, because some were sea people. I'm not being perverted. I'm referencing it to another episode that we did on the actual sea people.
The sea people.
Mm-hmm. But some were people who were coastal people. Some were
inland hunter-gatherer.
Mountain people.
Yep.
Some were farming. Some were.
They were doing
not
things.
Advanced. Agriculture, but they were at the very least the kind of bare bones, basic farming.
What's the word? The popular one was arboriculture, like farming trees. Like they would farm tree nuts and like, you know, lacquer trees and things like that.
But I guess the use of pottery in this region implies some form of sedentary life.
Yeah, totally.
Since pottery is highly breakable and therefore you wouldn't be able to carry it if you were constantly on the move.
Right. Totally. And definitely the presence of pottery, you know, one suggests this sedentary lifestyle, as you pointed out, and the Jomon settlements that they found, they actually found one that lasted like 1500 years, somewhere between 3500 and 2000 BC. So, you know, But it's pretty diverse, right? There was, like we said before, like a lot of nomadic and a lot of like sitting in place. And also a lot of this is really hard to pinpoint because we can't get good data points from that early. But there's some evidence of early agriculture, as you pointed out, you know, that date back as far as 4000 BC. But things like rice or millet farming wasn't introduced in Japan until a few thousand years later from, you know, China and Korea.
Japan was actually the last Asian country to adopt the practice of rice farming.
Yep, contrary to popular belief. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you think of Japan and rice as being synonymous with one another, but actually wasn't the case. But the Jomon, though, they were still mostly hunter-gatherers, or at least the evidence that we can find suggests this, and they were subsisting on the land and primarily living by the coasts. You know, you'll have to remember my little bit earlier about the geography changing. And there was a ton of evidence, you know, that actually found that they were reliant on a lot of marine life for their food. Excuse me. So for one, obviously the climate warmed, so that, you know, that created more coastline, right? More water. And then that also locked them into the Japanese islands. But more importantly, it also brought a huge population boost in fish and shellfish because the water got warmer. And they found, they've actually found huge ancient shell mounds, like in Tokyo Bay. Like, they found shells from when people were eating them, like giant mounds of them. Interesting point, they, in a lot of the skeletons that they found from the Jomon people, they actually showed this like specific bone development around the ear canal, which is actually extremely common among divers, which would give you the indication that they were, you know, doing like free diving and like spearfishing and shit, which is pretty interesting. And not a ton, again, like I said before, is known about these Jomon people, but, you know, what they have found, I think, is pretty interesting. One little bit that I found kind of neat was shamanism and rituals and like all this special like burial practices, and they had like stone circles, almost like Stonehenge, even snake worship. And for this part, I kind of want to put on my little tinfoil hat. So there are these things, and I encourage you to, you know, if you're listening to Google it, there are these little figurines called Dogu, D-O-G-U. And they straight up 100% look like spacemen. Henry, I asked you to Google it before we started recording. What's your take on it?
So if you guys have played the game Zelda Breath of the Wild, the Dogu is what they based the little shrines on. The guys that hand you the orb thing. You know what I'm talking about?
They're also related to the Haniya, which is part of the Kofun, but yeah, they're definitely in the same vein. But if you look at these things, though, they look like little spacemen. Like, they have like big old bug eyes and like bulb heads, and they look like they're wearing spacesuits. Look it up.
They do look a little bit ET-ish.
They look like dudes wearing spacesuits, like big, puffy spacesuits. Look it up.
I'm looking it up right now. It's spelled D-O-G-U if you want to join this search.
Dogu.
And yeah, they're pretty cool. They're neat. They're neat little trinkets.
Yep. Also, tinfoil hat. They did this snake worship, which I think is related to lizard people. Maybe they're the ones that built the pyramid off the coast of Japan. I don't know. Might be stretching a little bit, but don't rule it out. All right, back to reality. So we're talking about these Jomons, the Jomon peoples, and we're using that loosely. But if we were to like pin a close relative to the Jomon people, it'd probably be the Ainu people who live today. They're currently in the northern areas of Hokkaido, and also on the disputed island chain of the Sakhalin between Russia and Japan, which I really hope we do end up talking about in the later episodes of Japan, because I didn't know that they had this like beef going on between the two of them in those islands. Maybe we'll do a little bit of research on that later. But the Jomon, quote unquote, people and the Ainu, they share a lot of physical features and the DNA and stuff like that. And interestingly enough, the Ainu people have only recently been recognized as a native Japanese group. That was in 97, believe it or not. So not even that long ago.
What was the reason why they didn't recognize them prior?
racist reasons.
They just didn't want to admit that there was like a culture that was
that predates indigenous
to the region,
the Yamato people,
like the Japanese speaking ethnic group
that developed. Because let's like while we're on the topic, like I don't want to make this about like appearance, right? Because like ethnicity and DNA and all that stuff is different, but you kind of have to bring this up for this one. You mentioned it earlier. Japan goes through a bit of a racist bit through its history.
They go through more than just one.
Yeah. So this is kind of important, right? The Ainu people look different from what you would expect a Japanese person to look like. Nevertheless, they are, in fact, indigenous to Japan, or at least as indigenous as it comes, right? And as a result,
10,000 years is indigenous in my book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as a result of looking different, and not only that, but they're kind of like, I don't want to put down Ainu people, but they have more, how do I say this diplomatically? Their culture is less Western and less modernized than their like quote unquote Japanese or Yamato counterparts. And so I think as a result, they got dominated quite a bit. They've been relegated to like the furthest reaches of Japan, even though they used to basically be all over the northern area of Japan. And they're just kind of looked at as like second class, which is also important. We're going to talk about like the class systems, you know, that were set up in early Japanese periods. But yeah, man, it's racism, to be very honest. And then they just started doing a bunch of this, you know, DNA work and learning that all of these old Jomon people, actually the Ainu people, are closest to the original Jomons. So they kind of had to, you know.
Well, let's talk about the people who came in, because we got to talk about like when the second big migration to Japan starts, because there's another one in around 400 BC of the Yayoi people, right?
Yayoi, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was basically a caravan of illegal immigrants who came over from the mainland in search of a better life. And that was my joke for the Yayoi invasion. But for real, they call it the Yayoi invasion because so many people came over to Japan. It was like an invasion.
And like most ancient migrations, we're not really sure exactly where these people came from.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's totally unclear. You know, the Yayoi gets its name specifically from a district in Tokyo where go figure, they found a specifically different reddish type of pottery. The ancient Japanese really do like their pottery, and the anthropologists who find them love to name shit after pottery. And rice too. And seriously, this is when rice starts becoming cultivated at scale and sticks around.
So these people, from what I've read, no one really knows. There's arguments all the time about who these people are and where they were from. There's some theories that they came from Southeast Asia, from like Laos.
Yeah.
And Vietnam and those areas. There's other arguments that they came from Korea. There's other arguments that there wasn't really even a migration. They were just the Jomon, which doesn't really make sense given all the DNA testing, but that isn't like another theory. What I thought sounded most feasible to me, and this is not the opinion of an expert. This is just someone who, a casual history fan,
a normie,
looking at all the theories presented, and the one that made the most sense to me is that these were refugees of the wars in China.
Yeah,
that were going on
very likely
during the Warring States.
Yep, very likely
that poured in as the Qin dynasty was uniting together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very likely. Very, very likely. And
because they're coming from, I think the most agreed upon term, the one that's most likely, is that they came from North China. So right. Korea, Northern China,
through the Korean Peninsula. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why I think Japan believed that they had some type of right to Manchuria during World War. Well, they invaded in 31, but in the 1930s, because they were like, oh, well, you know, our people come from there. But yeah,
and,
that's what I felt.
And they were distinctly different too. Like these people, the Yayoi people, were lighter, taller, and they also brought over a bunch of new shit. Things like iron, bronze, and rice. Here's a fun conspiracy theory, Henry. You ready for this one? I think this might be the last. No, I've got one more after this, but this one's
sure.
Fun. Okay. So there's this fun conspiracy theory that posits that around the same time, right, we're talking about, you know, the 700-ish or the between 1000 and 400 BC is when the Yayoi started coming over. But around the same time, the Assyrian Empire had scattered the tribes of Israel. And there's this idea that many of them went east and that some of them ended up settling in China and eventually went over Japan with the Yayoi invasion.
So is this like a reason to create Jewish settlements in Japan? Is that what they're using this as?
I don't know, man, but maybe. Well, hey, there's some shit that's pretty interesting that they found. So one of them was that there's a ton of similarities between Jimmu, the, you know, that first emperor of Japan, and Moses in their stories. There's this like weird, like, kind of racist idea that there's these Portuguese Jewish racial features on some Japanese people, and that those are like the Portuguese Jewish Japanese people or something. And also they've cited some similarities between Shintoism, which was the, you know, ancient religion, and Judaism. That part doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but there was some very fascinating finds. And this was around bronze weapons that sprang up at the time during the Yayoi invasion. And they share some pretty similar, like, and very interesting similarities to the ones that were used in ancient Israel and in you know, Mesopotamia at the time. So, I mean, you know, trade happened across the entire world, but we're talking about the very ancient world. And now suddenly some of these bronze weapons share some pretty interesting similarities with one another. Around the same time that these peoples were scattered from, you know, the area. So I don't know. Maybe.
Well, there's another theory. There's another theory about Jesus coming to Japan.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there is. But that didn't happen until later, of course. That's an even funner theory. So the Jesus apparently had a brother, and Jesus's brother was the one that got nailed to the cross, apparently. And Jesus went back to Japan. And I'm saying back because apparently he spent a lot of his time between the age of 12 and 30, you know, the lost years in Japan, evidently. And apparently he went all the way to Japan after his brother got crucified. And he married a woman and had three daughters. And apparently there is a line of people who claim to be descended of Jesus. And again, this kind of like, you know, like plays into the idea of Japanese people having like divine descendants, you know, from Izanagi and Izanami, or from Amaterasu, you know. That one's fucking fascinating. There's like a shrine to the like burial site of Jesus Christ in Japan. It's so fascinating. Jesus is actually Japanese. Even better, Japanese people are Jewish, and that's why Jesus came back to Japan.
Okay.
You see that? That's the connection there.
I think we found the mystery of who the Jomon were. I think something that's important to note, and this is going to be a continuous theme in Japanese history, is the... So bronze, iron, and agriculture revolutions all entered Japan at the same time period, or relatively within the same centuries. This resulted in rapid modernization
yeah.
And this is a reoccurring theme. So I say a reoccurring theme because later on in the 1800s, Japan goes through the process of modernization in a very short period of time. It only takes them about 40 years or so to do about 200 years of modernization. What took the European countries 2 centuries to do, they do in about 3 to 4 decades, where they change their political system.
Yep.
They completely change their military to where not only are they defending themselves against Western powers, but they're defeating them in wars.
Mm-hmm.
They defeat Russia in a war very shortly after their modernization process. They also defeated China before, which was a much larger country. And you see that same theme going back into 2,300 years ago, where they are getting all of this technology all at once. It's like steroids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like I just started listening to Dan Carlin's podcast on the Japanese Empire. And this is the first episode I listened to in the series. And something, a really good analogy that he uses for the nation state is that Japan was a society on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
Like they took steroids to catch up.
Performance enhancing drugs.
100%. But the steroids ultimately were... they had a huge consequence in their health.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They killed that government as it was.
Yep. Yep. And I think, go ahead.
Oh yeah. I was just going to kind of continue on to the point you were making. The invasion kind of moves gradually.
Yeah.
Like mostly in like the south and the southwest, as opposed mm-hmm. to the north, where effectively the Jomon are at this time. And it kind of creates this culture gap between the north and the south, given that, you know, the agriculture and technology revolutions are going down in the southern part of Japan. And I guess this is where you really see the split in cultures in this time period.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why there's the Innu in the south, in the north, excuse me.
Right, and also the ethnic makeup there too, right? This is kind of the ancient start of like this split between like the Ainu and the Yamato people today, or the, you know, the Jomon and the Yayoi, you know, in the south. You can make those comparisons here. But in the South, there was very distinct social hierarchies that started popping up as a result of all these changes. And I want you to think of it this way. So metals, as we said before, a lot of resources are rare in Japan, right? Because it is an island chain. Natural resources are sparse, but metals were even more sparse. And so the ownership of metal ore or metal items created a super high status for you, you know, like it's literally gold, you know. And rice farming, which is new, and well, I mean, they had been farming rice there for a little while, but like not at this, at the rate or the scale that they start doing now. You know, rice farming starts to centralize control over populations, right? Because they have all the food now. And it also created more permanent settlements. And both of those factors and a bunch more put together basically played into this creation of the idea of territory in Japan. And these territories needed to be defended, and prosperous territories needed to expand to maintain growth. In this period alone, the population grew to 2 million, which we're talking about. That is a nut stat for as small as the region that they were in. And this obviously creates a ton of tension and conflict and ultimately war. And it also created this kind of feedback loop, right? So if you had metals and rice, that meant you had metal weapons and for killing people and food to feed your soldiers that killed people. And that won battles. So this really helped to solidify this social hierarchy as well. So they created these social and intertribal kind of rankings. And, you know, they had these customs that even till today, you know, or at least through the 19th century stuck around, which was You know, if you are walking down a road and, you know, you see someone of a higher social rank coming, you know, in the opposite direction as you, like towards you, you step out of the way and you bow because you're a lower social rank. And that is some, like, aspects of that still continue till today. And then there was a ton of other developments, things like silk and glassmaking and a bunch of other specialized trade. And so they started actually physically trading goods and commodities among these tribal areas to help to distribute resources a bit. But also, like, if you just weren't fortunate enough to, you know, where your tribe didn't sit on top of an iron mine, then, you know, you had to figure something else out to survive in that economy. What this created was a tribalization of the Yayoi people, and it led to chiefdoms and small kingdoms and a bunch of, you know, everything I just described.
Well, let's jump into the written history, more specifically how China looked at them. So all the written history of this period comes from the Han Dynasty in China.
Right. Right.
So they're not. There's no written history that's coming out of Japan. It's all coming out of the spectators,
right?
Which are the Han Dynasty, which has some delegates and explorers, or really whatever people who are reporting back to the Han Dynasty court, like, hey, look what's going on over here.
Mm-hmm.
But what is written in their ancient texts about Japan is. It's kind of humorous. It's kind of funny what they write.
Yeah.
Because I guess they're shocked that Japan is so decentralized, because mm-hmm. they have this imperial system. They have all these. They're coming off this war where they basically just united. It wasn't the Han Dynasty. It was the Qin Dynasty before them. But they're holding together this.
Super state
that was bounded by blood and bounded by all these crazy alliances by Emperor Qin, and then inherited by the Han Dynasty. And they're like, why, how are they so discombobulated?
Yeah. Meanwhile, across the river, look at these crazy ass people over there.
And I'm not sure what the populations were at this time.
Well, China's population was giant, and at the time it was the Yayoi people was about 2 million, if you don't include the Jomon in the north. But the Chinese definitely eclipsed them in population. But again,
I'm just wondering by how much. Was it 20 times? Was there like 40 million people in China?
I don't want to get quoted on that. Let's call it like 20 times. It's just some ridiculously large. They had way more people, but. The real issue was the population density. Japan's really small, you know, and like people per square foot, per square mile in Japan was like much higher than
if you,
in China.
If you take interesting geography trick, if you take not a Mercator map, like a real map, you put Japan and you compare it to the United States, it's about the size of the East Coast. It stretches between all of its islands. It stretches from. Florida to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But the catch is that only about 25% of the land there is livable.
Right.
It's all mountains. It really is all mountain ranges. So I don't want to beat a dead horse, but it's just so important when talking about defining, because ultimately I think the thing that defines culture and culture defines political systems is the geography. I think that's mm-hmm. number one thing that defines how a culture turns out is
for sure.
What are they living like? What are the circumstances that they're dealing with?
Mm-hmm.
Are we dealing with trade and water Are we dealing with like trade routes and other cultures and merchants? And are we a merchant society? Are we a mountain society? Are we a desert society? I'm just like labeling different.
Yeah, totally.
Not doing a good job at this.
No, it's mostly right. maybe not the desert.
The point I'm trying to make though is that where you live ultimately defines what your culture values are.
Right.
And
how your culture develops.
your culture develops based on the geographic distinctions of the particular area that you live in.
Right.
So people who are by water sources or river sources are more likely to be invested in trade. People who are in the Great Plains area, like a big plains area or grasslands like in Mongolia, are more likely to be really awesome with horses, you know?
Right. Animal husbandry.
Yeah, they're going to be really into animal husbandry.
You made a good point, and we should get back to it actually, though, because you were saying how China basically we understand everything we know about this particular bit of Yayoi history from China. And there's this one text called the Han Shu.
Jesus, I felt so off.
Yeah,
I don't know how I ended up where I was.
It's fine, but this part's funny. So the Han Shu, which is the history of the Han, they talk about the land of Wa, which is what they referred to Japan to at the time as, which roughly translates to the land of the dwarfs, which I think is hilarious. And they talk about how it's comprised of 100 kingdoms, and they're just like so flabbergasted at how is it that you have 100 kingdoms in such a small little like island. And then later in the Wei Chi, which is the history of the Wei, there's a section on the quote Eastern barbarians, and they included the Yayoi Japanese people, and they specifically talk about one of those kingdoms, and they call them the I'm going to butcher this in Chinese, but the Sima Tai, which in Japanese translates to the Yamatai. And these people are really fascinating, and I kind of want to talk about them for a bit. So these Yamatai people were initially ruled by this like weird shaman queen lady, and her name was Himiko. And basically she was into like magic and shit, and she was apparently super paranoid, and she lived permanently in this big ass fortress, and it was apparently guarded by 100 men, and she was served by 1,000 women and one guy. Lucky guy.
And the one guy was like her personal messenger. Like he did all the outside communication.
Right. He did all the talking. Mm-hmm. And she ended up continuing a common practice that was already in place among the Yayoi, which was sending tributes to the emperor in China. And people in Japan, chieftains and stuff like that, they would send tributes to the emperor of China because they're trying to appease him and they're trying to be recognized as a ruler by him, like to, you know, get brownie points and stuff. But this woman, she got a bonus because the emperor not only ended up recognizing her as the sovereign of her particular territory, but he recognized her as the sovereign of the entire land of Wa. And so they established this like fun relationship where they're sending gifts back and forth to one another, and you know she's getting like iron and gold and stuff like that, and she's sending him like slaves and silk and other textiles. But this elevated status for Mimiko meant that when she died she needed a big ass tomb, right? Because she's, you know, gangster, and apparently it was 100 paces wide, whatever that means. And these were called Kofun. And they're basically raised mound tombs, like big dirt tombs, but they're super, super interesting. And I think the last conspiracy theory I'll bring up on the show. This is more ancient alien theories, but they're kind of like ancient Egyptian tombs, or even probably more like old Nordic mound tombs. And the thing about them is that they look like a keyhole. If you look at them from the sky, they look like a key. Google is Kofun, Kofun. When you look down on them from like a plane or a drone or something like that, they look like a keyhole, and they're very ornate, and they're often laid out in interesting patterns, and you can really only see these patterns from the sky. So like, who are they making the patterns for? It's for the
aliens. It does look like a keyhole,
right? And what's really interesting about this is that apparently nobody can excavate the Kofun to learn more about them. Why? Because they're all owned by the emperor. They're imperial property. It's a no-go. It was all a big conspiracy.
This is interesting.
And then from this period, from this Kofun period, there's also those Haniwa statues, which are also related to the, you know, the shrine dudes in the
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, Breath of the Wild. Yeah, the Haniwa statues.
I hope you guys are as big as dorks as we are. Then if you're not, it's going to go right over your head.
Right. So yeah,
they are. Gotcha.
Ancient, dude. This is all aliens. I'm telling you, man. This is one day I want to know what's in the fucking tombs. You know.
One day we're actually going to do an episode on ancient aliens, and I'm hoping that we get the most convincing ancient alien enthusiast that we can get.
I want Giorgio Tsoukalos, the guy with the crazy hair with the meme when he says like aliens.
No, I don't want to create. I want a guy who's gonna like convince me that it's real.
Maybe he's kind of old. I hope he doesn't
Mulder,
die.
Like from X Files.
Maybe Eric Von Daniken.
Is he an ancient alien person?
Yeah, he's written so many books. Chariots of the Gods. That's a good one. Yeah, he's an interesting dude, but he's old. So we'd have to get.
I've never really read anything on ancient aliens. I usually just roll my eyes and look like, ugh.
It's fascinating, God. Man. You know,
I sound honestly. My critique of it is, it comes almost from like a left wing. It doesn't sound like a left wing, but it comes out sounding very left wingy.
Yeah,
that I feel like it's kind of racist. I feel like it discredits these ancient cultures and their ability to do things.
It is definitely diminutive, but what I find fascinating about it is that, you know, much like with this Japanese history where there's more questions than we have answers, you know, there's a lot of things in you know, ancient history that we learn and, you know, we dig it up with archaeology and it's super fascinating, but like it loses the, you know, magical mystery to it, right? And so Ancient Aliens is just kind of like that little that itch that scratch that, you know, scratches the itch of, you know, that mysterious magical, you know, greater than, you know, humankind thing. You know, it's fun. It's just fun.
To me though, the truth is more interesting. The fact that these people were so advanced so early on in the process of modernization is just incredible to me. What really piques my interest is when you find things from a really ancient culture. So I'm not talking about like ancient Rome. I'm talking about something from a culture from 1000 BC.
Right.
That 3,000-year-old culture.
Right, you know.
And you find something that looks like it could have been made relatively recently.
Right, and you're like, how the fuck did you build this?
Like, how did you build? Like, how did you build the pyramids? How did you build all these structures in ancient Mesopotamia? It's just amazing to me. Because I couldn't figure out any of this stuff. I would never be a person who could figure out an irrigation system.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to figure out the wheel. I'd be like, whoa, this is a little too, I'm getting old too fast. This wheel thing is, like the wheel to me would be like, you know, TikTok. I just wouldn't get the technology.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let's wrap up on the Yamatai kingdom, because I think it kind of leads into the next period that I want to talk about before we break for the episode. But, you know, it's not super clear where the Yamatai kingdom was. A lot of experts link it to the Yamato area in the Nara Basin. They're probably the same, but it's not very, very clear. But what's important to know about the Yayoi people, or the Yayoi period in general that we've been talking about, is that it marks the transition out of this Neolithic period to a period of actually recorded history. So prehistory to history. And there were huge leaps forward from hunting and gathering to cultivation, and from tools, like stone tools, to metal tools. And, you know, there was fixed settlements to social and social hierarchies. it was basically the makings of a state. Like, this is really when we're starting to think about, like, the Japanese state, or at this point it was called the Yamato state.
The first government.
The first government. Government.
The first, like, real recognized government of Japan.
Right.
Was right. The Yamato Kingdom.
Right. And this is sometimes also known as the Kofun period, because it refers to the period where they created all of these massive key-shaped burial mounds that we were just talking about a bit ago. But obviously it's called the Yamato period because of the Yamato state in the Nara Basin. And, you know, the dates and hard facts about this, again, are pretty unreliable because of reasons that we've already described. But the first verified emperor of the Yamato period was Suijin. And he died probably around 300 AD. Some people think that Suijin was the leader of a group of invaders from Korea called the Horse Riders, which I choose to believe because that's a fascinating story. So Suijin and the early Yamato people, they actually are pretty cool. They used politics and negotiation more than they did military battles to gain power and grow. And they preferred to incorporate local chieftains and, like, basically give them, like, titles and power and high levels of in their hierarchy, basically to make them feel special, and also so that they have like, skin in the game for the expansion of the Yamato Empire. It's very, very fascinating, because before that, it was just, like, try and crush your enemy. And for these guys, it was almost like the opposite of if you can't beat them, join them. It was more like if you can't get them to join you, beat them. If that makes sense to you. But the Yamato people, I think, you know, this government was definitely among the most powerful of the clans that existed during this time. But it wasn't until about the 6th century that the Yamato stood out as, you know, the juggernaut that it would become. That's when other rulers in the region would start paying them tribute instead of everyone paying the Chinese tribute. But the Yamato were also instrumental in the promotion of Buddhism in Japan. And you know, among many things, you know, religion is super important for the development of a nation state, mostly because of, you know, the shared ideology that comes behind it. And the story behind this is pretty interesting. It's also indicative of, you know, the cultural and ethnic makeup of the Japanese people, the Yamato people of the time. Actually, a lot of their high-class families in the Yamato Kingdom, specifically the Soga clan, were actually originally Korean. And they had this, they already had this affinity to Buddhism, which was already popular on the mainland. But specifically, these Buddhist scholars introduced Buddhism from the Pakchi Kingdom in Korea, which was the southernmost kingdom in Korea. At the time, there were three warring kingdoms. And sometime in the mid-6th century, that's when they came over. About 100 years before that, those scholars from that same kingdom had come over to Japan and introduced the practice of writing. So writing became a thing in Japan, and the Yamato ate that shit up. So writing helped the spread of Buddhism. And
Buddhism, they ate that shit up, man. Writing, that's shit's awesome.
It was true, dude. This is like, you know, we actually started seeing like an explosion of writing coming out of Japan at this point. They really liked it. They were like, oh, this is cool. You know, look at this shit. I could write down ideas. That's awesome. You know,
I've been obsessed with this show called The Last Kingdom. I keep on talking about it, where I've converted some people to this show. A lot of fans have reached out to me like, yo, Last Kingdom's awesome. And they'll even admit, like, the acting's not great, but it's still awesome. Like, but there's a part in the show where one of the Viking warlords, he discovers all of King Alfred's, like, scrolls, and he's like, this is magic. This is magic. I must learn this magic.
Yeah, he eats that shit up. It's writing, man. It's awesome. But so Buddhism, writing was important because it helped spread Buddhism. And Buddhism was important because it was seen as politically advantageous. So it helped create this, like, national ideology for the Yamato nation. And it also helped give some itself as a kingdom some genuine credibility among the Chinese and their counterparts on the mainland, because they were all Buddhist at the time. And Yamato wanted to, well, in one way, Yamato wanted to prevent invasion from the definitely more powerful Chinese empire. But it also just generally wanted to learn everything that it could that it thought would be useful for itself as a growing nation. I'm referring to the Yamato like kingdom, like it's a person, but it's expedient for me. So I guess what you need to know from this bit is that, you know, when you think about Japan, a lot of the times when you think about old history of Japan, you might think, oh yeah, that they're a closed off nation and, you know, they're their own little special thing. And that is true for certain periods of Japanese history. But for this period, they were so open. They were so open that they were literally like copying off of each other, like copying off of their neighbors, like stealing as much as they can to make themselves better. And that's kind of fascinating because it really developed this ideology in Japan of adopting the best parts of all of the cultures you can get your hands on, which I think is pretty cool.
Which mirrors the future.
Yep.
And the future being during the Meiji Restoration in the 1800s. And I'm going to keep on bringing this back because I think it's really useful. We're trying to...
We're learning.
It's fun to go through the early... It's fun to go through the early history, and like it's really important. The goal is to tie this into a narrative of how a nation state is built. So we're looking for links and similarities between modern Japanese culture and ancient Japanese culture. And this really is similar to when the Japanese were modernizing and they were copying all these Western countries. So they were picking and choosing the best of each Western country. So Prussia, oh, Prussia has a great standing army. We're going to copy them. Britain has the best navy. We're going to copy them. France has a good political system. We're going to copy them. So they're picking and choosing the best European country at, you know, whatever they want to improve on. And they're just basically just sending their Japanese advisors. They're learning how to do it. And they're going back. The Japanese advisors are going back and they're teaching, you know, their school how to do it like the Europeans are doing it at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But this period here, it sounds like a very similar period where they're very eager to modernize because at this point they're behind. Like, let's quite frankly, Japan, the islands of Japan are behind China and Korea.
Yep, by a lot, yeah.
And that, by a lot.
Like a lot. Remember, a huge gap. They were referred to as like the weirdos, the barbarians over there that like, you know, squabble over like the little bit of land, you know? And they developed this really interesting relationship with Korea and the Korean kingdoms. At the time, there were three. They got really tight with the southern two. So basically, it picked up Buddhism from them. It picked up writing from them. But they also did a lot of trade with Korea, especially around iron ore. So this is where they're getting all the iron to create the weapons of war that they need to, you know, basically consolidate power on the island. And they had some conflicts with the northernmost kingdom in Korea called Silla, but, you know, I guess some things never change. North Korea versus Japan, you know. This one dude, Prince Shotoku, who was half Soga. Remember, the Soga people were originally from Korea. He basically re-established missions to China after it had reunified under the Tang Dynasty. Keep in mind, like, China was much bigger, but it went through some warring periods. We covered a lot of it in our prior episodes. But at this point, the Han Dynasty had fallen and then reunified under the Tang Dynasty. And at this point, Prince Shotoku, around 600 or so-ish, he started sending emissaries over to China to start learning stuff from China. And the one cool thing that he pulled over was this social hierarchy based on hats. Like, the type of hat you wore told you, like, what social hierarchy you were. So it was like, I don't know, it was cute. So Shotoku, he also drafted this thing called the 17-Article Constitution in 604, which basically tried to establish a central government. And it was very much Chinese-inspired. It heavily drew from Confucianism. And it was probably less of a constitution and more of like a guiding set of principles than anything. But, you know, it was all about like harmony and loyalty to the imperial line and all this like flowery nonsense. But they definitely were looking to like adopt very Chinese things. In 645, there was a coup led by the Fujiwara no Komatari. That was 614 to 699 or something like that. And they changed a lot of things, but they didn't change the idea of promoting everything Chinese in Japan. And they put in a bunch of reforms based on the Chinese model of central government. And these were called the Taika, or the Great Change reforms of 645. So a couple things that they did, there's a lot of things they did. They had major land reform. So they nationalized land. So paddies were basically allocated by the government. So every 6 years, every free adult male, I'm going to put this out there because there's a lot of slavery at the time. So if you were free and you were an adult male, every 6 years, you're going to get about 0.3 acres, and females got 0.2 acres. Also at the time, they had multiple like wives and stuff like that. So it would behoove you to have as many wives as possible because then you get more land. Other reforms that they did was like taxation in the form of produce and not labor. So like they wouldn't tax the work, they would tax what you created. Restructuring like hierarchical ranks, like in one in particular, they established a, I'm skipping around here, but they surveyed a lot of the various local officials because there was a lot of like corruption going on. So they first try to figure out, all right, are you actually the rank that you say you are? And two, are you doing corruption? And if you are, they're going to kill you and try and eliminate corruption. So that was pretty interesting. What else? Oh, they established a permanent capital. That was a big one. At the time, it kept bouncing around. They put this capital at Naniwa, which is present day Osaka. But it only stuck around for a couple of years, but that was like super important to centralize power.
This is a common theme. The capital of Japan frequently changes.
Yeah. Like a lot.
Throughout its history. A lot.
Yeah. What else? They took people's guns. Well, they didn't have guns. They took people's unauthorized weapons, which is very liberal. A lot of very Chinese things, these people put into place. And through this Yamato period, the population grew again by about 2 to 3 million. Here was the stat. I actually wrote it down. China's population has had more than 60 million at the time. And we're talking about the Yayoi having 2 to 3 million. So that's orders of magnitude more, huge difference. Even still though, Japan's population at the time in the 7th century was way, way bigger than any of the European nations, any of the European populations at the time. So it was still formidable in that respect.
Well, what's interesting is that even prior to them modernizing, and when I say modernizing, I mean modernizing into their modernization process in the 1800s, Tokyo was the largest city in the world, even right prior to the West coming.
Mm-hmm.
So they already had a huge population centers, and I guess you can see the reason why a lot of these population centers in Japan and China and India, why they're so big, why their population is so big, is because they started out with a big population.
Yeah.
It's a large part. Mm-hmm. So they just kind of like accumulated it. It's kind of like a 401k, you know what I mean? Just like accumulated over time.
Mm-hmm.
We are at...
Yeah, I guess we can kind of stop here because we're almost at an hour and 30 if we lob off that first couple of minutes of us bullshitting with each other. But I think, what do we learn? We learned about, the creation myth of Japan. We talked about the geographical implications of Japan. We talked about the early inhabitants of Japan. We talked about the Jomon specifically and who they were. And we talked about the Yayoi, who eventually took over most of southern Japan. And then eventually we got onto the Kofun or the Yamato period, where we really start seeing the building and the creation point of a nation state, for Japan. And I think we did a pretty good job at setting up some themes you know, for future episodes about it. Do you have any closing remarks on this?
I'm excited to dive deeper into this. So we're soon going to get into Samurai.
Samurai.
I guess that will be one of our next steps. But, you know, we're this series is a work in progress. This is the first time we're doing something like this. So we're just hoping that we're just trying to make the most entertaining and thought-provoking thing that we can make. The China stuff was a experiment that kind of sort of turned out like this, and we're trying to replicate it and just not only entertain you guys, but hopefully get you interested in these types of things. But I mean, that's all I have to really add to it. I just want to thank everyone again for joining us today for another episode of Bro History. Man, it is 11:30. I feel like it's 2 a.m. right now. I am tired. But thanks again for your attention. It always means so much that you guys continue to tune in every week. Make sure to rate and review the podcast. Rating and reviewing the podcast is the number one way to help us grow. And you guys have been awesome rating it and leaving us reviews. In the past 2 months, we've received about 50 reviews. So keep on doing that. Yeah. Just keep on rating and reviewing the show. It really helps us continue the momentum and continue to grow. If you want to continue supporting us as well, you can also join our Patreon, where we put additional content up. We're going to post our weird banter we were having prior to the start of the episode on the Patreon, if you want to get a sense of what we need to do to prepare for the show.
Yeah.
What do you mean? What do you need to do? What do you need to do to prepare for the show? Trust me, it's a work in progress. And also, I just want to announce, we were on the show War and Conquest last week. Neil, who runs the show over there and who's the host, you know, he had us on and we had a great time on the show. We are going to play a little preview of his show so you guys can listen to what it's about. Right now, he's currently in a series about Vlad the Impaler. It's really interesting. He does a great job breaking down the origins of the Ottoman Empire and their invasion of the Balkans and the resistance movements that came out of the Balkans. And he focuses on Vlad the Impaler. So it's really interesting. We're going to play a little bit of a preview of the episode that we were on. I encourage you to go to War and Conquest to get the full episode and listen to the rest of his content. Anything else?
No, man. I think that's pretty good.
All right. All right, guys. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next week. And peace be with you.
Peace.
So who was Mehmed II, and why did he have to fight Vlad III Dracula? If we believe in Machiavellian principles, the confrontation was inevitable. And I feel like this really fits well with the theme of the show we're going to do next, because Machiavelli once said famously that war is only to be avoided at your disadvantage, meaning that sooner or later your neighbors are going to get envious of your territory or resources or have some imagined or real insult that is going to cause them to invade your borders. So, in that vein, you may as well just attack them first, because the attacking army almost always has the advantage, especially if the receiving end of that is not really prepared for it. And so, in between the years 1460 and 1461, Vlad the Impaler would do just about everything in his power to antagonize the Ottoman Empire into attacking him. Which may seem like a really idiotic idea, considering the Ottoman Empire was one of the most dominant civilizations in the world at the time, with possibly the most experienced soldiery and cohesive unit in, well, world history, actually. The Janissaries don't get enough credit for just how skilled they were at killing people when they were together. I mean, 1-1 against European knights, the Janissaries probably lose, but as a cohesive unit, the Janissaries were almost unbeatable. I say almost because we just covered the Siege of Belgrade, and we saw how if you have enough really pissed off peasants in the right situation, you can beat the Janissaries. But 9 times out of 10, when the Janissaries are sent in, it meant the destruction or retreat of the opposing army. But Vlad the Impaler realized that Mehmed II was bent on world conquest. After all, he was a man who was raised in the shadow of the classics like Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great, who believed that he was better than them and in a better position to achieve the ultimate dream of world conquest.